You're listening to The Last Exit Show with Caleb Horton and James Murphy.
All right, I believe it's time for a story that I wrote 8 minutes ago. You want to hear a story I wrote 8 minutes ago? Sure you do. Sure, you want to hear it. Now, the quality control is just through the roof for something I wrote 8 minutes ago. I'm so spectacular at doing stuff under pressure that this is going to come out totally coherent and lucid. Let's do it.
I'm on itch mustard.
Most people would call it a routine vacation in England. Caleb Horton wasn't most people. He resented the idea of going. But in college, all of his rich friends went there and beguiled him with stories of the damn place. First of how awesome it was, then, later, how epic it was. They would speak in exultation about how different England and California were. For starters, bars are called pubs there. Drunk driving is called drink driving. And alcoholics are sometimes called alkies. But Caleb was immune to these charms. He was only going to prove to those rich kids that he could rise out of poverty and do rich people bullshit as effectively as the next guy. He was going to prove he was better than that kid with all the Nazi memorabilia whose dad ran AT&T. So Caleb started saving. Right away, he went into business for himself and did it the only way he knew how, by becoming a drug dealer. First he sold some marijuana, then Oxycontin, then cocaine. Then he started using and lost everything. Then he sold some marijuana, then Oxycontin, then cocaine again. After 3 years, he had enough money to blow up a mailbox and steal a Sacramento lobbyist tax refund, and off to London he went. His friend, James Murphy, waited by the phone for news of his arrival.
Oh boy, I can't wait for Caleb to show up, is what I would say if I was a protagonist in a comedy sketch, but no, I don't care when he shows up.
James waited anxiously by the phone, desperately hoping for news that Caleb's plane had arrived safely. He was so excited to see his old friend that he could hardly contain himself.
Hey, fantastic, a huge bottle of vodka.
Suddenly, without provocation, James resolved to determine exactly what had happened to Caleb. He got out his phone and started dialing the only person who could help in a situation like this, really. The United States Ambassador to Great Britain.
Hello, is this Matthew Barza, the United States Ambassador to Great Britain? Oh, he's retired. Well, shit, get me his replacement before I walk down there and chuck this huge bottle of vodka at his head.
This aggressive strategy proved useful for James Murphy.
Hello, acting United States Ambassador to Great Britain and United recording artist Kid Rock. But I don't know exactly what happened to my... No, I don't want a pre-release of your new single. I'm not, to be honest, Kid Rock, I'm not even aware of your back catalog.
30 minutes went by as James Murphy valiantly fought through bureaucratic red tape and double talk.
Wow, the Detroit rap scene sounds pretty intense to put it that way, Kid Rock.
And 30 minutes turned into an hour as James grew increasingly frustrated with Britain's inefficient and stodgy sense of order.
Yeah, we both know David Allan Coe is supposed to be this huge racist. But when you put it that way, he sounds like one of the most upstanding performers in the business. I mean, if he could sweep backstage passes for me on his next tour, I'd... You know, it's so awesome to find another person in London who likes rap and country music as much as I do. I'm just floored, man. That's awesome. I can't believe that Hank Williams Jr. is over there. He's even better than his dad, if you ask me. Like, when you look at how many songs he wrote, he's way better. Hank Williams Jr. is way, way better than Hank Williams.
An hour turned into 2 hours, and James Murphy was no closer to learning the fate of his friend Caleb. He wanted to scream, but knew it would get him nowhere, and that made him want to scream more. He was powerless.
Okay, sure, I mean, let's start there. Critics say that you're pandering to quote-unquote white trash. But it's only like you said earlier, they choose not to perceive the respectful side of you. I mean, let's just list the people that you work with. Rich Rubin, who produced, in my opinion, Johnny Cash's own few albums, Jerry Lewis, Willie Nelson, Snoop Dogg, and not a lot of people know this, but even R.L. Burnside, the last of the great Hill County Blues. Your resume is about as respectful as it can be for something like that. As you said, you're touring level.
Finally, he couldn't take another second and he slammed the phone down in anger. He was just so mad it's almost indescribable.
And I think the most respectful thing to do, if we want to play that game, is that you keep the ticket prices fair. We live in an almost post-apocalyptic world, and you're out there, you're making people happy, you price your tickets absurdly low. I don't even know how you turn a profit. Like, Bruce Springsteen positions himself as the populist rock star, but if you look at the huge pay cut you've taken by enforcing affordable tickets, it's hard not to see you as the greatest, the single greatest performer in the idiom of rock and roll music. Anyway, bye Kid Rock, see you around.
So James logged into Facebook both to vent his frustration at the ineptitude of his government and to see if there were any updates about Caleb. Maybe his plane was just late. Then he saw something that shocked him and reduced him almost immediately to tears.
What's this say? Damn, I need my reading glasses. Okay, here we go. Update from Caleb. Oh God help me, I'm being viciously murdered by drug dealers. I've already missed my flight. Lights, see, actually, and they're kidding me.
All right, that's enough, sir. I'm ashamed of my own work there. See, sometimes you write a sketch, but you don't have any motivation to write anything, so you just take a one-sentence bullshit premise and you run it into the ground. And you don't. What happens when you do that is you stop checking your facts as diligently as you're supposed to. You know what I mean?
I understand that, but you know, they say that even the weakest material can be carried by a strong performance, and I think that's what we've proved within the opening 5 minutes of our show here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm upset because that sketch is riddled with inaccuracies. I mean, you don't even wear reading glasses.
No, I should, though. I'm one of those people that's so lazy they've never been to the optician since they told them at 16, you should probably wear some glasses.
I'm so glad that my eyes work correctly. My dad wears reading glasses, and those are apparently very expensive. You got to pay a lot of money for glasses. It's terrible.
It is terrible. Are you bragging about your 20/20 vision there, Caleb?
No, I'm not. I don't have 20/20 vision. I've already established that I burned basically a hole in my eye by staring at the sun for too long when I was 9 years old or whatever.
Just everywhere's got this black circle everywhere you look.
That really seems to, thematically, that really gets most of my life together into a nice box. Pre-staring at the eclipse and post-staring at the eclipse. That's when the darkness started winning, I think.
Literally.
But no, what was the conceit? The conceit of that sketch was that I came up with this line when I woke up. The line being, United States Ambassador to Great Britain and Atlantic recording artist Kid Rock.
Yeah, he's a talentless hack, is Kid Rock.
I don't know, what if he's good? I have no idea, I've never listened to a single thing he's done.
He's got a song that I know quite well. It was a huge hit around the time that I was really plugged into stuff that NME Channel was playing. And it was a song, you've probably heard this song, it sampled Sweet Home Alabama, and it was about singing the song Sweet Home Alabama.
Didn't it also sample Werewolves of London? Wasn't that the other big hook about it?
Possibly. I mean, they've both got the same riff, ain't they?
I think I said... Yeah, I do remember that song. It was quite a summer jam, wasn't it? I love those summer jam songs.
One of those songs about singing other summer jams. It's an Aruburus. It's a snake eating its own tail.
Man, I felt really bad because the Black Keys seriously do have a new summer jam, one of those songs that needs to close out the show before the encore at festivals so that everybody can sing along to. And I really like that song, even though I kind of have grown to resent what the Black Keys have done. And I have to reconcile some shit to enjoy it.
Okay, so for the audience at home, what is it you don't like about the Black Keys?
You know exactly what I don't like about the Black Keys. It's real music posturing that codes as being extremely false, and also that fake rivalry with Jack White. I mean, when you get right down to it, don't worry, guys. You don't need to be fighting over anything. Neither of you invented white blues rock. It's fine. You can share the mantle of being white blues rockers who do Zeppelin riffs.
There was a debate in the 1960s. Can white men play the blues? And I think the question really should be, should white men ever bother playing the blues? Because Jack White, I think he should just be a country star, and that's where he should live. But I like the White Stripes. But yeah, I think mostly just let the blues be something that Elmore Leonard played. Nope, he's an author, Caleb. That's not who I was trying to say.
You were trying to say Elmore James. That's right. Played a mean slide guitar, didn't he, Jimmy Murphy?
I did. Not the man who wrote John Travolta for the movie.
But being real talk for a second, the my rule about white guys playing blues, I mean, obviously, it's never something that I endorsed. I generally only go for the original Delta guys and, you know, the Chicago folks and the survivors of the actual blues scene, not the scholarly types. But
yeah.
White people should be allowed to play it if they're itinerant enough.
If they're close enough to homeless.
Exactly. There's some really, really good and learned white blues players who I really like because they keep the sense of danger intact. The problem with all those British guys is that they were learning those records too tightly, I think.
Do you ever listen to C6 Steve?
Yeah, I really like C6 Steve. I started out with nothing and I still got most of it left. Yeah. I just burned a copy of that for somebody actually this morning.
That's a great album.
That is a great album. I think Grinder Man is on that. That makes it right in my music that's embarrassing for me to admit that I listen to territory, I think, but I do. I stand by it.
It's embarrassing because it's so much within your niche.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't appreciate the cartooniness of Nick Cave as much as I do. I like that he's a Looney Tunes character version of a Southern Baptist preacher. It's a great shtick, I think. I laugh at him a lot.
And there's good songs at its heart as well.
Yeah. I don't want to try to get into an academic defense of Nick Cave. This is probably not the time to be doing that. But hey, you know what, though? So I believe for about 14 consecutive episodes, I have mentioned Bobby Womack without provocation.
Yeah, look what you've done now.
Yeah, I killed him.
Yeah.
I killed Bobby Womack in Los Angeles, James Murphy.
That was a real shame that you chose to do that.
I know, I really resent myself for doing this, but it's true. Obviously, this proves A, that the show is cursed, and B, that I have some sort of magic powers to kill celebrities that I love.
Wow, yeah, it's more of a burden, really, than a power.
I've had the same thing happen, where I'm talking about the performer earnestly.
Yeah.
And you would think that this is an extremely unlikely coincidence, but that's for most people. For me, the kind of music that I like is all played by octogenarians at this
point. Very old men, yeah.
Right, so it makes sense that I would talk about somebody and they would die immediately after I'm done talking about them.
I remember when you killed George Jones. I'm not sure if I've forgiven you for that yet.
Another huge example of this is that I was having a conversation with my brother. It was about 1 in the morning. And we stayed up until 3 in the morning talking about how wonderful Doc Watson is and how much we love Tom Dooley and Shady Grove and all those wonderful songs that Doc Watson played.
Yeah.
And then the very next morning, bam, Doc Watson is dead.
Hang your head, Caleb Horton. Hold your head and cry.
Gilmore, Laurie Foster, and you know you're bound to die. I love murder ballads.
I know. I don't know if there needs to be any songs that aren't about murdering people. I think that's all that pop music, folk music, and dance music should confine itself to.
Oh, speaking of murder ballads, Murder Ballads is actually my least favorite Nick Cave album. It's a gimmick record.
Although, it's got 3 great tracks on there.
It does, but it's still a gimmick record, ultimately.
And it's not as if all the rest of his albums weren't just about murders.
Yeah, but I'm upset about Bobby Womack because he really was one of my obsessions. Like, if you put me in a room with no external stimuli and left me alone with my thoughts, 10-15% chance I was thinking about how awesome Bobby Womack is.
Bobby Womack's one of those guys who started out, well, I think he started out even in the 50s, and he seemed to cover every decent musical genre. He was Sam Cooke's protege, and after Sam Cooke died, he married his wife, which people hated at the time. And then he was just like this, played like guitar for Elvis. He worked with Wilson Pickett. Just basically anything that was great about music in the 1960s, Bobby Womack seemed to have something to do. And then in the 70s, when he was finally allowed to start making solo albums again, he took it all to the next level. He got into this mad funk space spectrum. Mm-hmm. And then he had the balls to do that country music album, which I adore.
BW goes CW.
Yeah, it's fantastic album.
You know, Bobby Womack was, it's terrible how early all those soul men died, because you got Sam Cooke and Otis Redding dying right next to each other way before their time, and they really, Otis Redding was born in what, 1940? He should be making records still.
To this day, yeah.
wonder what that would even look like. I imagine it would be a lot like Bobby Womack's trajectory. He probably would have staggered into cocaine. There would have been a couple of, you know, relationships that went desperately south, and then hard times in the 80s, and then the, you know, comeback with hard beats in about 2009 or whatever.
Eventually, a vampiric Damien Albarn would put some beats underneath him, tend to see.
Oh, boy. But I'd love to have some revisionist opinion about what the best Bobby Womack songs are. But actually, I think the consensus picks are actually pretty reliable in his case. I think it's obvious what his best songs are, and they're the hits that they deserve to be.
I like his original version of the Stones song as well. I think that sounds great and so much better than what the Stones did with it.
I also rather enjoy, even though I don't think it totally works, but I rather enjoy the duet version that he did with Bill Withers, which I think was after a reaction to how much he hated the Rolling Stones version at the time.
Yeah, he was bitter as well that they really acknowledge him, you know. They didn't really say he was right. They just tried to pass it off as a Stones song.
No, I think they've, whatever crimes they committed at the time, they've long since paid for. I'm sure he probably warmed to that song. Well, actually, that was mentioned in the BBC documentary I watched about him, which is excellent. I think it's just called Bobby Womack. But I think he warmed to the song once the royalty checks started coming in.
That'll do it.
But If You Think You're Lonely Now, I think is kind of a perfectly produced soul song. And Across 110th Street is obviously unstoppable.
Yeah, it was almost a shame that Tarantino revived Across 110th Street, because it made it kind of a kitsch object for Jackie Brown, which is a film that I liked, but I feel like it's a song that works best in its own context.
Yeah, I've actually never seen Jackie Brown. I thought about watching it once a couple of years ago, and then I saw that the running time was very, very long.
It's a long film.
It's been sitting there in my DVD player since 2012.
Pam Grier is excellent in it.
I love the cast. It's just way, way, way too long.
It's a film that you hang out with, you know what I mean? You don't expect too much plot to take place, but you just kind of enjoy being with these characters.
Mm-hmm. What you know what? After he died, I made a discovery about his early career. I knew that he originally was out there and being branded as the Valentinos and then the Womack brothers, with him being the lead singer in both instances. But their gospel recordings are totally fantastic.
And I've heard some. I watched that same BBC documentary, and the little snippets that they played, it really makes you realise how much people describing those 50 things as rock and roll is just good sounding gospel, because I'm cursed with southern gospel and current gospel at work all throughout the day, and it's so insipidly white bread. And then to hear people like the Womack brothers singing that, and the likes of Sister Rosetta Tharpe, it's a completely different genre almost. It's a shame that that's died out in the churches almost.
Well, you're talking about radio gospel also, too, so we don't need to arbitrarily say that gospel is all ruined now, but I know what you're talking about. That strain of gospel music is extremely terrible.
The gospel music that I hear is terrible.
Oh, it's all... No, I know the radio format you're talking about, and it's extremely saccharine. It's kind of like listening to AOR,
yeah,
but, you know, with Christian lyrics. Yeah. So, you know, what I like gospel to be all fire and brimstone, and Bobby Womack knew the fire and brimstone inside and out, which made him one of my vocal heroes.
And bass to it as well was true.
Oh, yeah. Looking for a Love is also a completely unstoppable song. I think that was based on, they mentioned it in the documentary, but Looking for a Love, I think, was just a rewrite of Yield Not to Temptation.
Which is fine. You know, everyone was doing it at that point. You Send Me by Sam Cooke. That was a gospel number, and all.
Mm-hmm. And Check It Out, another great. But there, he was generally pretty unstoppable. I like on the country album his version of Big Bio. He really nails the chorus on that. I don't know if that was by Rod Stewart originally, but his cover of it is definitive as far as I am aware. Oh, speaking of his country and western album, you've seen the photos from that session, which is kind of the Harlem cowboy look that he had going on with the leather western shirt and the sunglasses and the pipe. You've seen the picture I'm talking about, right? Him on the horse.
Yeah, he looks real cool in that. It's not even, doesn't need to be perfectly captured. I think it's just such a cool image.
It's a very, very cool image. But what I was getting at is, what do you want? $5 says that the origin of Quentin Tarantino doing Django Unchained was he saw that album cover and he said, movie's written, done. Yeah. Blaxploitation Western, done. But one of the great things about Bobby Womack is that he's what you imagine Sam Cooke would have been doing if he had survived being killed in that hotel.
Yeah.
Because it's just these huge gravel, fire, and brimstone soul songs that you can put right next to Otis Redding without pretense.
I prefer Womack's voice to Sam Cooke's as well. I think as much as I enjoy like the live album that I do with Sam Cooke, it's... I like a rasp in my voice. I like a little bit of wear and tear on it, and Toots a little bit too smooth for me. Bobby Womack feels like he's a little more grounded, a little more earthy.
Right, I agree. Which live album do you have? Harlem or Copa? Harlem. Okay, yeah, I think that's a pretty unstoppable. That was actually my introduction to Sam Cooke, because for years I always dismissed Sam Cooke as being too smooth next to the blues men I was listening to from the same time period.
Yeah.
And then I hear all the studio songs. They were kind of at this intersection of pop and doo-wop and, you know, let's put on a suit before we sing, guys.
Which is something I like. I do appreciate that type of music as well.
No, I do too, but at the time it was not very exciting to me, and I wanted more excitement. And then eventually, after I had all but dismissed Sam Cooke as being the guy who did A Change Is Gonna Come, you know, I got the Live at Harlem album, and it completely reconfigured what I thought about the guy.
Yeah.
No, he's screaming in half of that album. It's amazing.
Astonishing energy filled performance there. Yeah, and it's the instrumentation of it as well. It's just pumping it out, almost James Brown style.
Mm-hmm. I love on Somebody Have Mercy, it's just he's yelling. He's got this room-filling, just earth-shattering yell, which is the same thing Bobby Womack had.
I liked in the documentary, they were interviewing Bobby Womack, and he was talking about James Brown, and Bobby Womack's like, James Brown, we just thought, was the most evil man in the world.
He might have been, from what I've heard, I've heard people say.
Yeah, possibly.
I love that bit where he said, so Janis Joplin calls me up, and I said, hi, this is James Brown.
Yeah.
Because it's a very antisocial joke, but he no longer has any appreciation for what a funny joke that is. Yeah. And he's deadpanning it so bad. Hey, this is James Brown. Yeah, it's a real James Brown. Don't worry about it, Janis Joplin. That cover of California Dreamin' that Bobby Womack does, the studio version, is one of the 5 or 10 best covers ever, as far as I'm concerned. You know, at that point where songs stopped being interpretations or rewrites or communal property and started being covers as such.
Please hang up for me. Was that written by the Mamas and the Papas, that song?
I know it started with the Mamas and the Papas. I don't know who wrote it. I can't stand the Mamas and the Papas. They got this Laurel Canyon weird hippie cult vibe going on that upsets me and disturbs me, and I'll never be able to listen to them. Maybe if I was, you know, in Southern California with AM radio as a household mainstay in the 70s, my opinion would be different. But
I only know that song of theirs, and I don't dislike it, but Bobby Womack takes it into the stratosphere. It seems to be coming from, like, being directly from space into your brain. It's got, I don't use the word psychedelic, cause that's an overused word, especially in regards to music from the early 70s.
It's also not a psych song. It's straight up just a huge soul song.
It's just done from the left. Do you understand what I'm saying? It doesn't seem to be coming from the same planet as that folksy, churchy version that the Mamas and the Papas did.
Well, when you think about it, it just feels like a rocket ship taking off. It's hugely inspiring when you're driving. It's one of those songs that I consider one of the best songs ever, because when I'm driving, it makes me want to speed.
Yeah.
It makes me just want to drive 100 miles an hour and go change my entire life around, you know, pull into an office and go, I'm taking a job here. I'm a cowboy now.
Any song that makes you want to commit any kind of a felony has to hit, you know, top 500 easy.
Right, which is why Raw Power is a huge go-to for me.
Yeah.
But I think his cover of California Dreamin' is... It stands alongside Johnny Cash's cover of Hurt as ringing the most emotion possible out of a song that didn't necessarily earn that that reaction, you know?
I do, yeah. It's I wouldn't put it up there with Hurt, as in, like, I think it's better than that, just as an artifact, just as a piece of recording. I think, I don't know, Hurt's definitely been hurt by the fact that everyone and their brothers covered it, and it's held as this encapsulation for a life and career that Johnny Cash didn't actually lead. and Bobby Womack's California Dream, and it's dancing on Venus, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. It's well, the great thing about it is that it's putting the fear of God into a place where you weren't expecting it, which is what I want. That's what I want out of a cover of a song.
Yeah.
Is to crank up the fire and brimstone to 15 in a place where you weren't expecting a good song to even exist.
Sure, definitely. Even if you look at I Fought the Law, the Clash's version of I Fought the Law, I take a nice country song that doesn't seem to mean very much at all, and it's suddenly about trying not to die.
No, California Dreamin' is his cover of that is my most played song on iTunes right now, and it has been for a couple of years, and so he's been, Bobby Womack has been in my headspace for a long time. Let's talk about the comeback album, actually, Bravest Man in the Universe.
Do you know, I haven't heard that album.
Well, then I'll go ahead and take the lead from you here, and I think it's better than such things are supposed to be.
What?
Never mind Damon Albarn being involved temporarily. The obvious reference point for that album is I'm New Here by Gil Scott-Heron.
Which is great.
It is great, but I think The Bravest Man in the Universe, judged strictly as music, will age better, because whereas Gil Scott-Heron on that album was a half-dead crack addict who brought a grand total of, I think, one song to the table, and, you know, even when they padded it with him talking, he barely skirted the 28 minutes to constitute an LP instead of an EP or whatever.
And the music to that as well was extremely of its time. You know, I haven't heard the Womack comeback album, but I feel like it would have a little bit more timeless quality, and that Jamie from XX remix, all that sort of stuff, it's so very whatever year it was, 2012.
Well, I don't even... that the Jamie XX version of that album really upsets me, because it came out... I don't know if it upsets me. It's I am sort of repulsed by it, actually, because it came out a grand total of 2 months before Gil Scott-Heron had died.
Right.
Or something like that. And if you... or maybe the same day or something like that, but it was made as Gil Scott-Heron was actively dying of his crack addiction.
Right.
And if you had paused to pay any attention to a Gil Scott-Heron show or an interview or even that album, you would know that he was still using.
Yeah.
And it's inappropriate to, I don't know if I want to use that word here, but it's crass and obscene to turn his cover of Bobby Bland's I'll Take Care of You into a huge dance smash while he's sitting there in a crack den watching boxing and, you know, with a butane lighter and dying.
Yeah. I love, to give Jamie XX his due, I love the song Islands. That's as a piece of slick, modern, intelligent pop music. I think it's very high on my list.
Yeah, and I do really... his remix of I'll Take Care of You is fantastic to me, I think. I can imagine being in a club and dancing to it, and it's cool to hear Gil Scott-Heron's voice in that context. But I just don't know if I'm cool with it.
Right, I understand. Going back to Womack's comeback album, what was the music like on there?
Right, well, the point I'm getting at there is that I think the principal difference between the two albums is that Bobby Womack was actually bringing songs to the table.
Right.
And they're good lyrics and they're good songs, you know, by and large. And they got him playing all the hip festivals and getting him out there to a new audience. And he was a really energetic performer, even as he had Alzheimer's and all that stuff.
Yeah, even, and he was an unwell man physically as well. But
right,
he had a, even there at the end when you could see the cylinders weren't there, if he was, you know, 80%, just him and an acoustic guitar in that BBC documentary flicking up left-handed in the way he did. It's enticing, you know, it's very endearing and charismatic, which is something that you can't buy.
Right, and if you look at, well, I think the live show kind of speaks to maybe how exploitative one album was versus the other. Bobby Womack was able to actually go out and play his new album Whereas Gil Scott-Heron was touring with his whatever his pickup soul jazz band was, essentially doing the same set that he'd been doing since 1985. He didn't even acknowledge that he did that new album, really. I think he did that Bobby Bland cover at the piano, but that was about it.
Yeah, as you say, it seemed, even through his illnesses and a very specifically tragic illness, that whilst he was on the stage, he still had the tour of Bobby White, Matt.
What I'm getting at is this. I'm new here. It is basically a bunch of trip-hop instrumentals featuring, you know, FT period, Gil Scott-Heron.
Yeah.
And the bravest man in the universe feels... It may not be. Damon Albarn may have written all those songs and they were trying to prop up Bobby Womack and get him out to the festivals to be nice to. I have no idea. But it feels like a regular Bobby Womack album. I mean, it's a like a concept album. Bobby Womack, 2011. And the concept is Bobby Womack in space. And it works.
Yeah.
As it works turning that into a cosmic place with a lot of electronic instrumentation and Some of the songs are really wanting for horns or a guitar part, ultimately. Because there's a few where Bobby Womack just really doesn't seem at home with nothing but synth. There needs to be some soul instrumentation going on.
I don't know. I'm back and forth on the idea of capital M modern music. Because as much as my whole music world is oldie worldy past stuff with one foot in an acoustic folk tradition. But then the other part of me that kind of doesn't believe in everything is like, oh, fuck, well, I just put some dance beats under anything and it'll be fine.
Yeah, I waver back and forth, but I think it's a good album and the songs on it are lucid, effective, strong songs. Mm. And I don't think it's any more offensive than the ridiculous synthy, almost Michael Bolton-y instrumentation of Someday We'll All Be Free. I mean, he's had career missteps that are more egregious than this, and I think it's more listenable than the adult contemporary stuff that he was getting toward in his last days as a recording artist originally.
You know, no old artist survived the 80s and the 90s with any grace.
Nope, none of them. But one thing, I was listening to a lot of his music over the last couple of days. One thing I noticed, have you ever listened to the lyrics to Looking for Love?
No, not really.
Okay, well, let me tell you, Big Jim Murphy, they're problematic. They're very problematic lyrics, and he didn't write it. I'm just saying they're problematic. But check this out. So, someone to get up in the morning and rub my head. Someone to fix my breakfast and bring it to my bed. Someone to do a little housework and pamper me again with lots of love and kisses. Now, you're not looking for a love, Bobby Womack. You're looking for an actual maid.
Yeah, that's a one ad if ever I've heard one.
A maid would solve 90% of your problem. If you hadn't confused lover with maid, maybe you wouldn't have had to, you know, go marry Sam Cooke's widow 3 months after he died and got exiled from the music industry.
Oh, shit, that's it. Yeah, this wedding was a bad idea. What I wanted here was, someone just to pick up after me, really.
Maybe if he had taken a step back away from the lyrics of that song, he wouldn't have had this shit kicked out of him in Chicago and had all his ribs broken by some of Sam Cooke's cronies.
As his ribs got broken, he scrambled for his teeth on the floor. He thought, fuck, no, it was the other one. I didn't want a wife.
But I think it's worth listening to. It's worth investigating, even if you, at this point, you'll be pretty distanced from it. But it's his last album was a pretty good album. Although I would recommend a good two-disc anthology over that, obviously, as an entrance point if you're not familiar with the guy's music.
Sure.
Oh, shit, we got to throw to commercial. Wow. I love ice cream. I'm Jack and I love ice cream. That's why you should come to my place, Jack's Ice Cream. Other ice cream places, they get all sentimental about family history to deflect attention away from their inferior product. Because they're frightened, scared of people like me, and scared because I do it better. Why do we do it better than people like Jerry's Ice Cream? For starters, our recipe's better. It's Italian or some shit. But most importantly, we don't have to prepare for a small land war with the murderers from Hell biker gang because we can't pay the simple, affordable protection fee out of some misguided sense of American stick-to-itiveness. I pay my protection. Do you understand me? It works, the protection. So I don't need any guns in the back room. I don't need to scare customers when they come in the door. I don't need to be scared of the murderers from Hell Biker Game because they provide a service. They keep the bad guys away from my door, and they constantly bring in customers who are nothing but excited to check out my product. No guns needed here. Murderers from Hell are a benevolent, solid organization, and Mad Dog is a great organizer, not some thug like Jerry makes him out to be. You really did a bad thing, Jerry. You really fucked up letting him go to jail like that. Mad Dog didn't deserve that. You know what, and if you're listening, get over here, Jerry, you little prick. Pay the protection racket, you useless son of a bitch. Whatever, Jack's Ice Cream, 12th and Oleander, and just remember, the murderers from Hell Biker Gang are great. They're not trying to make your life harder. Pay the protection racket, Jerry, it's not that fucking hard. They're making it simpler for you. They provide security, Jack's Ice Cream, 12th, Oleander. Get down here, ice cream, family, ice cream. And we're back.
So, Caleb, a hero to both you and I played the Glastonbury Music Festival, and that was Dolly Parton. And it was a real shame to see the British media, and this is where I take a sound effects style spit on the floor after announcing them, trying to grapple with the phenomenon.
You should make it the Looney Tunes sound effect if you actually do it, the one where the tobacco juice goes into the spittoon.
Yeah.
Ding!
Yeah. Yeah. But the British media trying to grapple with Dolly and general British people shitheads on Twitter trying to work out exactly what this Dolly Parton person is with only the context of, you know, the 1980s and the fact that she's had some plastic surgery. So I've just been annoyed. But she put on a fantastic show, a real great set. And it was interesting because Blondie were playing the same festival, mm-hmm. and Debbie Harry looked and sounded like an 85-year-old woman, and Dolly, you know, was her, which is pristine glamour, you know, a little bit, you know, plastic surgery does no one any problems, but I won't begrudge someone for changing their face in a way that they feel happy with. And
bullshit.
Well, so I won't begrudge Dolly Parton for doing it. How about that?
Yeah, no one could, because she has an ethic about it.
Yeah. But, yeah, the British people were just sort of like, oh, Dolly, you camp feminist icon. Mm-hmm. Here's some country songs that I heard my mum playing. And it's like, you don't get it. You aren't appreciating her on the levels that I'm appreciating Dolly Parton.
That was the vibe that I got when I was watching a documentary about her a while back. Apparently, she did a big comeback tour a few years ago in London. I don't remember what venue she played. She played some big venue in London.
Uh-huh.
I want to say it was a bit like 5,000 seats or something, and she was doing this big residency.
Yeah.
And I got the feeling that she's deeply loved over there, but in a kitsch way.
Yeah.
Strictly kitsch, because nobody would... In the interviews that they did, I mean, not that this is a representative sample of a single thing, but the interviews that they were doing with people said, you know, she really puts herself out there and she's doing it her way and she's an icon, you know, but they weren't saying, I liked her stuff with Porter Wagoner or no. She is steeped hugely in bluegrass in a way that makes her able to go the distance as a performer, you know.
And like fantastic songwriting up through her many dozens of albums.
I mean, obviously, she's allowed herself to become a kitsch icon, which is fine, you know, since she's completely in control of it.
I think it suits her purposes.
It does suit her purposes. But the fact of the matter is that when she's playing, you know, anything in a bluegrass or old school country tradition, she's a genius. She's really, really great.
Yeah. I think with Porter Wagoner, it's great to look at him in interviews and shit and just see how... how much he regrets his shitty conduct in those 10 years.
He was pissed.
Yeah.
I don't think it had anything to do with Dolly Parton. I think it had everything to do with the Porter Wagoner, you know, the stock in that business is way down.
Yeah. Because he's not an especially talented man. He's got no great charisma. He's got no great singing voice. What he mostly had was an ability to exploit young talent.
I remembered that his last album, Wagon Master, was a good album, but I remember that seemed like maybe a bit of a novelty album at the time. Wasn't there a Jack White connection? He took Porter Wagoner on the road, or who cares?
I'm sure. The only positive thing I've got to say about Porter Wagoner is I'd love to buy some of his shirts and wear them around the place.
Oh, those shirts are great. Porter Wagoner knew how to dress, pal.
Yeah, Dolly was up there, and there was some controversy, as you know. Controversy, bollocks, whatever. There was some shit people were throwing, saying that Dolly Parton was miming at Glastonbury, completely misunderstanding, like the sort of cabaretness that mm-hmm. you get with these old country music stars. Like, they don't believe in a one-to-one audience connection. They believe in playing to the very back and getting big laughs as they play. And also just the underestimating of a person's talent, you know, because you're not used to someone who can actually sing a lot. Not that I'm being not even my dad, my grandfather, you know, these young people can't actually sing. But I think you have to prove yourself night after night on stage if you're at that stature.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fairness, I mean, her act is very Vegas. I don't know if I would actually go see a Dolly Parton show, but I have a lot of respect for her. I would go see a Dolly Parton show, but it's not the aesthetic that I'm interested in, really.
Sure. I mean, I wasn't going to pay the amount that she was asking.
No, never. It's kind of like Elvis in the 70s. I mean, I get it, but I'm not riding with this either.
She comes from this cabaret, and it's very Nashville as well, compared to the Bakersfield sound that we were talking about earlier. And the Bakersfield sound is more honest. It's probably more in my wheelhouse. But in terms of this older music, I don't think they have that authenticity. In a way, it's a lot more real than these... I don't know. For some reason, Justin Townsend's name sprang to mind there. Someone who has a beard and a plaid shirt. I think you're better off in sparkles sometimes, but...
I don't know how much of a market there is for that with people in our age bracket anymore, though, you know?
Not in a rockist sense. In a hip-hop sense, it definitely is.
Oh, yeah, in hip-hop, but... I don't think Steve Earle's kid is going to suddenly have his numbers blow way the hell up if he starts strutting around like it's Las Vegas.
Nah. And I do hate that inauthentic, which is a stupid word for me to use. I hate barriers between a performer and the audience. I like it.
I came up with that, you know, the intimate country music and then moved on to the intimate punk rock thing.
Yeah. It's not like I enjoy Neil Diamond and his glittery stuff. I'd much rather him pretend to be Ernest than play an acoustic guitar with Rick Rubin. But I feel like the best thing for the artist to do is be more honest with themselves. And Neil Diamond, if he's being honest, he's basically just a male Barbra Streisand. And if Justin Townes Earl is being honest, what he is a singer-songwriter's son who's going into the family business, and that's fine.
I'm with you on this, actually. I'm trying to think of any performers that I've seen who made themselves do... Like, I think if performers really end to being inaccessible, then it's music that I don't listen to. I think the genres that I like, performers are usually interested in cultivating the idea, which, I mean, accessibility itself, you know, can be bullshit.
Yeah, but I'll never... be moved, I don't think, by a Beyonce song, because I don't feel like she's a real person at all. I feel like Beyonce should, with a wave of her hand, have 17 Puerto Rican maids shot for the amusement of her baby child, and I think she's capable of doing it.
I need to get a pulse on the performer. I'm not very interested. I'm really not. I wish I could get away from that idea, because it would open up a lot of music to me, but it's just, it runs too deep in my blood. So if I don't know that you're a real human being and you live in a relatively normal house, then I'm just not with it.
And with Dolly, I don't know how much she lets people see of herself, but the bimbo image, for lack of a better word, does seem to suit her. And I think even through it, she does express something very real and genuine up there in the kind of the Dolly Parton's Dixieland Stampede cabaret feel of it all. You know?
Well, she gets away with it because she's so open about the fact that it's a business model when she is interviewed about it for so much as 5 seconds.
Yeah, well, it was great. She was talking about, this is just around the time Whitney Houston had covered inferiorly her song "I Will Always Love You," and Dolly was like, "Oh yeah, no, I'm glad more people are hearing this song. I'm really enjoying all this money it's making me." And you just have to like that, you know.
Right, that's being who you are, so that's good.
That dumb blonde ain't nobody's fool, and I think that yeah, it's just best to feel like the performers being themselves. I hate that I am seemingly hung up on this idea of authenticity, but I am, and I wish I could get away from it.
I love that we're both having this exact same dilemma in our 20s. I think some of it comes out of being poor and being so unable to relate to rich people, and you know, being in that tax bracket comes with a certain amount of artifice. There's artifice involved in being
day-to-day life. I'm quite a calm person. I very rarely lose my temper, and like, I'm pleasant to be around. I'm happy, cheerful. My life is really good. But like, sometimes I'll be standing on the train and I'll earnestly suppress the urge, you know, the intrusive thought to just murder a man in a suit.
I have been there when I lived in Malibu for years, and look where it got me. It got me down to some dark places. My school, a friend of mine pointed out about my old college, he said, you know, the reason your campus is a dry campus, it has mostly has to do with Dustin Hoffman not wanting to get into a traffic accident on Pacific Coast Highway. It has nothing to do with a morality clause. It's all about Dustin Hoffman not wanting someone slamming into his beachfront garage.
See, I couldn't deal with that in Los Angeles, because every time I've met a celebrity, and it might be through lack of exposure, I've turned into a diddling schoolgirl to them. There's an indie band called Little Man Tate, and I went and dropped my my wristband signed by them, and they were like, "Are you going to the show tonight?" And I just couldn't answer because I was so starstruck. I was 16 at the time, so I'd probably be better now. If you just see Dustin Hoffman wandering around thinking about what milk he's going to buy, then that'd be a real head fuck.
I still have giddiness around certain if I really respect a celebrity, I don't know what constitutes the difference between me being able to approach them as people and thinking they're magical creatures. With songwriters, I can be starstruck, but if I see stand-up comedians, I just think, so you've been on the circuit how long, and you're hitting what's the circuit you're hitting?
With musicians, it's probably more of a star style distance. With comedians, because they are disarming you from the off, they don't have that more approachability.
Well, I saw Johnny Depp once, and I saw him being ushered by several people into a town car after a show, and he was at a concert and he had to have his own little section, and he had to buy multiple seats, you know, just so that he could have some space.
Yeah.
And at that point, I couldn't process him as a person. So I don't think I would just be confused if you put me in a room with Johnny Depp. Seriously, that's what would happen. I would be, how do you live? Do you have people turn on your sink for it? I mean, this is obviously a horrible way to live, because you can't be in public. You can't be in public.
Caleb, I drink a lot of chamomile tea.
Salvadorian cigarettes. I watched The Lone Ranger, and I was really just... That was the first movie I've seen with Johnny Depp in a long time since doing that impression. I realized, wow, I really nailed it. That's a good Johnny Depp impression. Good job, Caleb.
So it's the 2nd of July now, coming up to your American Independence Day, which is a vile testament to genocide. What are you going to be doing?
I don't know. I'm kind of at an impasse, because the boy is... Well, let me tell you what's become of the boy. The boy... The 8-year-old Scotty is, I guess I can't live vicariously through other people, because he's gone on a road trip. He flew to Memphis, and then he went to Arkansas, where my grandpa was born. He's doing the whole journey of the Americans. He's doing the whole circuit, I guess. And right now he's in Austin, Texas, and then he'll be coming back to California. I have no idea when he's coming back, but it'll be a while.
So where you're left is in the situation of trying to fill that silence. I'd suggest setting off a bunch of fireworks and aiming them at your neighbors.
Right, I was thinking about it, but here's how this holiday works. If you have a family and you're And you can still pretend that you're close with your family. You can march up a gravel hill in oppressive heat and sit around for hours pretending you get along with the other people you invited. You eat some junk food and you wait way too long to see 20 minutes of fireworks, which are not, after you're about nine, they're not impressive anymore, but it becomes, there's an otherness to them that makes it kind of, it's a neat pastime. Fireworks are always neat because it's different.
I think with fireworks, and it's always been when I've seen fireworks, overly like safety measured British commons, and a couple of times some dangerously insane ones where friends got fireworks, and because of the nature of who those people were, I just hid behind some very heavy cement columns waiting for someone to lose a finger.
One of my key memories of growing up in Southern California was the fireworks stands in the grocery store parking lots, just these little wood shacks with tons of huge fireworks in them. And you could go up and buy some without a whole lot of hassling. Me and my friends on the street, we used to just blow up fireworks in the middle of the road during the day, and that's one of my few idyllic childhood memories straight up.
You know those American images of British red buses, you know, double deckers, you know the ones I'm talking about?
No, I've never seen anything in Britain ever.
Well, you get double decker buses, which means a bus with some stairs to the second floor. And
no shit.
Yeah, no, I'm blowing my mind quite a few times tonight.
Well, I'll tell you, Jimmy Murphy, I'm just a country bumpkin, but that sounds amazing.
Yeah, no, you believe it. You can buy the fireworks very easily from a corner shop. Also sold Milton pornography without any stress whatsoever. And so I'd be riding on these double-decker buses with a top floor, Caleb. And what would often happen was...
Shit, that sounds like a traveling mansion.
And so what would happen was someone would throw a
firework. Stairs, I'll be damned!
A lit firework down those stairs that I can hear you so impressed by. And the firework would go off, and we'd all have to get off the bus because a naughty boy had thrown a firework.
That's great. The thing about the 4th of July, I mean, I think this, I don't know if this characterizes English holidays as much as American holidays, but my association with most public events is tons and tons of walking and your car being very, very far away from the event. And looking for parking for way too long or looking for a good place to set up for too long and just being exhausted and fed up when it's over. Just really glad to be on a couch.
It was a revelation when I first started taking my two younger brothers to places because we could just leave when we'd had enough. You know, if you go out to your parents, you're like, I'm tired, I'm bored, let's go. For some reason, your parent would be like, no, we're going to keep walking past this pain barrier. We're going to put you in an even worse mood. We're going to drive for ages back home in a terrible hit of unhappiness all around. And like me and my brothers had gone down there on the bus and they were like, I'm bored. I'm like, I'm bored too. Let's go home. And they were like, yay.
Yeah, I've discovered the joy of leaving early. If you leave early enough, there's no traffic congestion. You can just go.
Yeah.
And a few weeks ago, I went to this event where a bunch of women jump off a bridge. And it was a 45-minute thing where all these women jump off a bridge. And after 20 minutes, I was like, okay, I'm done seeing all these women, these nice ladies jump off this bridge.
What was it, some kind of lemming event?
No, it was I don't know what you call it. It was like Cirque du Soleil. What is that, acrobats?
Right.
They were outside. We have this really tall bridge that's stolen. We hired some guy who built one just like it in Spain, I think. And so we have this bridge that's identical to one in Spain, and we pretend that we give a shit about it, even though it was just this huge waste of money. And so every once in a while, we feel obligated to do some sort of artsy event at the bridge just to enjoy the Spanishness of it or whatever the hell it is we're doing with it.
Right, yeah.
And so the idea was they had the suspension cables and they flew around in the air with their suspension cables around this bridge. Celebrate the fact that we have this Spanish bridge cost millions of dollars.
Millions of dollars that probably should have been spent making a few of your gas stations less abandoned.
Maybe burning all the buildings that have swastikas drawn on them, driving the criminals away to the Happy Valley down the way.
Not even repainting the swastikas away, just burning them so no swastikas may ever grow again.
Oh, dude, I saw the swastika that was on the gas station last week.
Yeah.
No one painted over it. You know what they did? They drew an X through it. Why do people think drawing an X, drawing the X through the swastika does not remove the swastika?
It's like a teacher giving a bad grade on someone's homework.
Right, exactly. It's not a proportional reaction. Just why don't you, if you have that much, if you have enough paint to draw a huge X through it, just cross the whole thing out. It's fine.
So, all in all, what are you going to do on 4th of July for yourself that you've got no little boy to entertain?
Now, yeah, here's the thing. If you're alone, I've spent a couple 4th of Julys alone. Here's what I've done in that event. Back in the day, it was day drinking in the oppressive heat and wanting to die the morning after waiting all that time for the fireworks.
Sounds pretty good.
But of all the holidays, if you're alone, it's the most singularly overrated. Because what are you going to do? I mean, there's no dumb ritual you can have by yourself on 4th of July except maybe watch Independence Day. And our town is so cut off from any national identity that all the patriotism associated with a fireworks show or whatever is really forced. Like pretending Christmas is fun after a divorce. Just nobody's buying this.
Your town would secede given half a chance.
They're trying to make a new state called Jefferson.
Kind of brilliantly, and everywhere in England is trying to secede at once. I'm really enjoying it.
Is that true?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. I want to have more sympathy with the secessionists because I think it would create some fun interviews.
I think it's a very healthy impulse to try and to leave the country.
I was thinking, our state wants this part of the California and the southern part of Oregon, they want to secede. And I understand the basic impulse, which is California is run by a hegemony of Democrats and it's only Republicans that live here. Yeah. But the problem is there's no economy here. So as a state, it would be the scariest state in the union because it would be a lot of drugs and people fishing and axe murders and, oh, it seems, you know, 19 people were killed with chainsaws today. Back to you.
Yeah, I don't like the sound of that at all.
So I'm very apprehensive about the idea, but I've told the story before, but I wonder how corrupted it's been by my poor memory. My best 4th of July memory is me and my buddy were out in East Bakersfield in a Hispanic neighborhood slightly outside of town, and we walked through the neighborhood half drunk, and it turns out the great thing about East Bakersfield is that nobody wants to go to the big show at the convention center or whatever. Nobody wants to park in that parking lot. So what everybody in the neighborhood did is it became this huge sphere of light and smoke because everyone had amazing illegal fireworks. It's impossible to overstate how great their illegal fireworks were. These were beyond, you know, quality illegal fireworks. These were the kinds that you have to fire out of a cannon.
Like tailgating outside the kind of arena.
Oh yeah, it was makeshift. It was just in the middle of the intersection, and they didn't block off the road or anything, and everybody was just drinking and having a good old time. So much competing stimuli. It was kind of the punk rock concert equivalent to the Convention Center's Bruce Springsteen concert, which is
you should find that place this year. That's my advice to you.
Well, it's 500 miles away. That was a bullshit comparison. Punk rock. I should ban the words punk rock from the show. Because everything you like becomes punk rock once you allow that intrusive thought to happen. When you think about it, coffee's really punk rock because it makes you more energetic than other people.
I make a mistake sometimes. No, I don't know why I'm going to say that. I enjoy some of Kevin Smith's podcasts. And for him, if it's something that he likes, it's like, oh, that's metal, man.
Right, you gotta be able to get away from those crutches, so I try to avoid the crutches. Twitter for the week.
It's a modern song, Caleb.
Yes, I love modernity. Now, yesterday I saw a windowless van that was the property of my old school. Remember that I flunked out of because I ran out of money and was essentially homeless? Remember that?
Remember that cheerful story?
Saw this windowless van with my school's logo on it. It was driving by the liquor store, and this was on a back road. This was not near the interstate. It was very far away from the interstate. And I had this palpable sense that they're the ones who have been doing this Norm MacDonald shit. They're the ones who have been putting all the Norm MacDonald stickers on those payphones by my house. They've been looking for me, and they're trying to get me closer. I know what's happening here.
Solitude does make a man paranoid.
Oh, boy, does it ever. I mean, wouldn't you have that reaction if you were in my shoes for a second before you said, no, there's no way?
I think so. I think I'd be worse and further down the line than you are now.
It's a really tempting thing to start doing, to follow that line of reasoning.
Yeah.
Because why are they there? I couldn't figure out a reason why this van was in my town. That school is 900 miles away. They have to be here to kill me.
It's nice because it makes you feel important when a lot of the time your life is just like you're an insignificant dust speck on the asshole of the cosmos. So to see these little coincidences is fun, you know?
Right, well, you know, when you're in the void, you take any stimuli that could be vaguely related to you, and you make it strictly about you.
Yeah.
Definitely. So that's kind of what I was doing with this van. But it, at the same time, what the hell were they doing there? What the hell was it?
It's entirely, you know, possible that there's another boy who's going to fail out of college and end up doing a podcast with someone in London.
Such bullshit.
I'll tell you what, I got distracted by my Twitter. It's a video that I found online. It was an American man, and he was a coach. He called himself Coach Pharrell. And the video is about a minute and a half long, and it's how to open, how to use a tin opener, you know, like a can opener. And it's wonderful. If you found this video, I know you're in trouble. And this is how you use the tin opener. And it just made me think, if there's ever, like, you know, an apocalypse or a giant lack of failing of electricity, we're going to starve to death.
I saw that video. He's using the can opener wrong, which is fantastic. I was laughing so hard. He's using the can opener wrong. How do you do it? Why would you make a video about how to use a can opener and then not do it correctly?
The dirty little secret as to why I searched that video was I couldn't open my stew, my Irish stew, my tin of Irish stew. So, like a complete fucking failure of a human being, I YouTubed it to try and find out how to use this this strange implement.
I feel like it wasn't clamping down on the handle of the can opener. I feel like that's the principal error in judgment Coach made when he was using the can opener.
But what a fine man to spend his time helping his community like that.
Oh, you know what? Somebody told me that I sound like, what was he said? He said that my speaking voice sounds like I'm trying to remember his exact words. He says it's like I'm explaining the scene of a grisly traffic accident.
Yeah, I can hear that.
I don't know if I can ride with that. Let me think if I can. So the car was in the middle of the road and it had flipped over two or three times, and the front wheels had been dislodged from the car, and there were two bodies in the automobile, which have been the coroner is on his way now. But what we're going to need to do is we're going to need to set up roadblocks across the entire intersection all four ways, because there's debris and scattered across six different lanes because of the angle of the impact. Does that sound, is that how you expect someone to describe a grisly traffic accident? Does that sound
good? It's how I'd expect them to describe that, and it's also more or less how you describe the Bobby Womack album that you really liked.
I'm awful. I'm a piece of shit. I should just leave society, man.
No, you're fine. We talk about you, lunatic. Yeah, I have realized just the other day that most of my politics has sprung from watching and rewatching the 1968 Charlton Heston version of Planet of the Apes.
Great,
I realized
movie.
Like my distrust of authority comes from the fact that science and religion was the same thing and they were lying. It's like, oh yeah, those apes, they really did shape how I feel. And Charlton Heston, like, talking through his teeth in a loincloth through a whole film. I really identify with him.
I love the ending of that movie. It's so nihilistic.
It's brilliant. It's
been talked about way too much, but that's the kind of ending I like in sci-fi. That is just doom that he's left with.
Yeah.
He's in hell at the end of that movie.
Yeah, such a great film.
Oh, I know. But, You know, maybe it's good, that grisly traffic accident comparison. Maybe I can, maybe there's careers in describing grisly traffic accidents. I mean, maybe we can say, more euphemistically, we could say that my skill is news reading.
Maybe. I spoke to someone last night, just the other day, who said that I should be a late night DJ, so soothing are my dulcet tones. But I only want to do late night. I only want to do late night DJing if I can record it at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, like Letterman does. I don't want to be going through my existential funk whilst I'm having to play some music, you know?
I went through a phase where I really romanticized being a late night DJ. I went so far as to get the keys to our campus radio station and try to do a music show, but there seemed to be no good way to play MP3s.
Part of it looks like a great job.
I didn't get very far in doing it, but what was it? The CDs that they had there were not good enough for me to mess with playing. I think they had Rather Ripped by Sonic Youth. That was the only real CD they had. All the rest of them were bullshit.
Right.
And name me one song on Rather Ripped by Sonic Youth. Name me one.
I don't know if I could name a Sonic Youth song.
Teenager Riot?
Yeah, I could name that song, actually. Well, I couldn't name it, but I know it now that you've said it.
Rioting Teenagers by Sonic Youth. Fucked Up Teenagers, Sonic Youth.
Do I remember that song correctly? Does it start out really boring for a long, long time, and eventually they get to a guitar riff that kind of matters?
I would describe it as ethereal, but yes, it's boring for a while.
Yeah.
I always like Kim Gordon more than Thurston Moore, which burned a lot of bridges for me. But now it turns out Thurston Moore is the asshole. So look who's laughing now. Eh?
History's proved you right.
I'm going to go ahead and relay a conversation that I had with the child. He's in Austin right now, and I got a picture of him forwarded to me next to the Stevie Ray Vaughan statue. He grew up, he's loved Stevie Ray Vaughan. It helps him go to bed. It's kind of his nightlight, is that he has to have Stevie Ray Vaughan playing when he goes to bed. So I respect and support that.
I don't like Stevie Ray Vaughan, but I like that he likes him.
Stevie Ray Vaughan's all right. It's not something that I listen to recreationally, but I've come to associate it so strongly with good feelings that, you know, what the hell am I going to do? It's kind of stuck on me. But anyway, I called him up on the phone, and I was so thrilled by this conversation I had with him, because I felt like it was the beginning of him having the same personality that I do.
Oh no, why are you trusting him with that?
Okay, not the same personality I do, the same sensibilities about what's funny, alright?
Okay.
So, he says to me, I saw the Stevie Ray Vaughan statue in Austin, and I said, oh, awesome. That's fantastic news, Scotty. And he said, yeah, I saw a Willie Nelson statue too. And guess what, Caleb? He's still alive. Willie Nelson is still alive. Why would they make a statue of somebody who's alive? And then I replied, well, Scotty, that's because Willie Nelson is a living legend. And then he goes, yeah, and Stevie Ray Vaughan died in a helicopter. He's a dead legend.
If you want to join the show, do it at Twitter, at Last Exit Show, which is on twitter.com. If you want to follow Caleb, follow him at Caleb Horton, K-A-L-E-B-H-U-R-T-O-N. And, Nia, what's my Twitter?
God knows.
You can follow me at _ James Murphy. So, and also, if you want to, donate to the show, do it at The Last Exit Show, which is at gmail.com. Good night, everybody.
I was a third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Been down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew that was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do until you put under pressure. Across the 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across the 110th Street, pimps trying to make a bone.
woman that's weak. Oh, across the 110th Street, where she's gonna let the junkie go free. Oh, across the 110th Street, where she's gonna let the junkie go free. Oh, across the 110th Street, you can find it all in the street. There's a better way out. Snorting that coke, shooting that dope, man, you're copping out. Take my advice, it's either live or die. You got to be strong, gonna survive. The family on the other side of town will catch hell without a ghetto around. Every city you find the same thing going down. Harlem is the capital of every ghetto town. Say across 110th Street, she's trying to catch a woman that's weak. Oh, across 110th Street, she's won't let the junkie go free. Oh, across 110th Street. I'm done. Thank you so much.